For the week of February 1st, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 267, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, inside the snowpocalypse, I'm Michael Giltz.
It's the snowpocalypse again? Wasn't it the snowpocalypse last week? And then it wasn't much of a snowstorm. There was...
Well, it was if you were in Boston and New England.
Okay.
It depends on where you live. You know, they can't predict exact paths of the storm. I was going to tell a story.
You were?
Last night, working in a diner, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., I went there, spent 3 or 4 hours there, and it's time to leave. I get up, I turn around, and like, oh my God, there's like massive amount of snow on the ground. Like, I had no idea. You know, I was so focused on my work. And I was just about to tell you that story, and I got up, went to get it some water. I come back to the table. Oh my God, I look out the window. It's snowing again.
Was this a planned snowstorm?
I don't know if one plans a snowstorm.
Well, but you know what I mean. Was it predicted?
Of course.
Okay, so is it supposed to be as bad as the last snowstorm?
No. But it's just, you know, 10 inches maybe. That's always a lot. You know, it's a normal snowstorm. Nothing crazy will happen. It's not 2 feet. It's not going to set a record. But, I had no idea. I was so focused on the show that I had no idea it was still snowing 5, 6, 7, 8 hours later after the last time I noticed it was snowing.
And we should point out, Michael, mm-hmm. that when you say you were working at a diner, you weren't working at the diner. You happened to be working, and you were inside a diner. You were working on your own work.
That's right. I was not a short order cook. I was working on Showbiz Sandbox.
Ah, okay.
What was I working on, Sperling? What stories will we cover?
Well, on this week's show, we'll be wrapping up our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival by giving you a rundown of the titles that were acquired, how much was spent on them, and whether there is any hope at all for them to make that money back for their distributors. Now, speaking of money, Sly Stone, you know who he is, Michael?
I sure do.
Well, he could be $5 million richer after winning a court ruling last week against his former manager. We'll also be telling you how Tom Petty wound up with writing credit and royalties, by the way, for Sam Smith's hit song, Stay With Me.
Okay. I didn't know Tom Petty was gay.
No comment? I don't know where to go with that comment. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, not just North America. We get our info from RentTrack. We have a link in the show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. Anywhere we can get info, we pull it in here. And the number one movie around the world for the third weekend in a row is American Sniper, the Clint Eastwood film starring Bradley Cooper. Movies with the word American in the title often don't do well overseas. People don't want to hear about it. But this one is the exception. You know, like Captain America, this one is proving to have legs around the world. It grossed $42 million. It's at $316 million and counting. The vast majority of that comes from North America. It's $250 million, but it's just started its overseas campaign, so we'll have to see where it ended up. And of course, this weekend was Super Bowl weekend, which means everybody was watching television, at least some part on Sunday, and that can often hurt the box office, but American Sniper had another great weekend even here in North America, despite being a manly man film and, you know, not exactly counter-programming against the big game. They thought it might set a record. But it didn't. Miley Cyrus, which is the best example of counter-programming against the Super Bowl that I've ever heard of, that still holds the record for the weekend opposite the Super Bowl, but American Sniper is doing just great.
So Miley Cyrus made more than $31 million then.
That's right, but that was the opening weekend for that movie, and I think that was the movie where they said, oh, it's only going to air for one weekend, and then they ended up extending it because it did so well.
Right.
But it was just a great idea overall. But American Sniper, third weekend, still making, you know, a big change here in North America. And number two around the world is the sort of movie that Hollywood would love to imitate. It's a Chinese film, and it's a reality film. It's like a it's kind of like Jackass, I guess, you know. They took in a reality show and turned it into a movie. In this case, it's called Running Man, or actually the TV series is called Hurry Up, Brother, because
okay.
Running Man wasn't allowed by Chinese officials. You have to have a certain number of characters in your TV show's name, and Running Man just wasn't enough, so they had to rename the show Hurry Up, Brother, and it seems like it's a cross between The Amazing Race and The Apprentice. You know, it's some sort of reality competition show like that, except all the contestants seem to be young and hot, which is not necessarily the case with The Apprentice. And it did tremendously well in the Chinese box office. I'm sure it was pennies to make. It spun off from this TV show. It grossed $35 million in China its opening weekend.
So basically, it's got somebody, some host on the show that says, "You contestant number three, you came in second. You are not the best. You are fired."
Something like that. Okay. Something like that. But in Chinese,
that's my
probably.
Bad Donald Trump, by
but
the
in
way.
Mandarin or Cantonese.
Okay.
At number three around the world is Taken 3, the Liam Neeson film, another $25 million. It's at $250 million. If you're related to this character, I would be worried.
That's true, because there's nobody else to kill. Now, did you see the television commercial during the Super Bowl that actually had Liam Neeson kind of mocking himself?
I did not. I did not watch. Don't ask me about the Super Bowl. I didn't watch it.
What?
I didn't even tape it. I forgot to nothing. I didn't see the halftime show. I didn't see the commercials. But the nice thing is now, if you actually care, you can go in 2 seconds, watch all the commercials online.
There was a Liam Neeson ad for a video game of all things, mm-hmm. where he's talking to the video game in his Taken 3 kind of, you know.
Sure, sure.
At whoever he's playing against, it's a multiplayer game, and he's saying, "I'm going to find you.
I have certain skills." Was it funny?
Yeah, it was kind of funny, especially when all of a sudden, I guess he's in a coffee shop, and they say, "Lion, your coffee's ready, your order's ready." And he stops, and he turns back into himself, and he's like, "It's Liam."
At number four is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, another $23 million. It blows past $900 million. It's at $915 million worldwide. It looks like a good bet to get to to $1 billion. We'll have to see. It's powered by China. It may stall just before that, but clearly a big final success story for the Hobbit movies. At number five is the Oscar-nominated animated film Big Hero 6, another $20 million. It has now tripled its budget. It's now officially a hit. It took a long time to get there, but Big Hero 6, by any measure, looks to be a successful commercial film.
Well, except for the fact that my kids now want to see Big Hero 1 through 5.
They're like, "Where are they?"
Yeah.
At number six is another animated film. This is Chinese. It's Boonie Bears Movie 2. The Boonie Bears Movie 2. We talked about the first one. This is spun off a TV cartoon series about some lovable bears and a logger in a forest. And apparently the logger always tries to cut down trees and the bears always frustrate him to protect their lovable forest. Well, this is the second feature film spun off from that show. $14 million, a solid opening weekend. Another family film right below that, Paddington. Another $11 million. It's about to pass the $200 million mark. And number eight is The Imitation Game, Benedict Cumberbatch. No, yes, that's right. Yes, The Imitation Game is the Alan Turing movie. It's really positioned itself well for the Oscar race. Another $10 million. It's at $130 million worldwide. At number nine is Project Almanac, another film that debuted in North America. It grossed $10 million at its opening weekend. It's a sci-fi found footage type of indie flick. I haven't seen it, but it's about kids time traveling back because of an invention of their dad and they have to prevent him or something or other. I don't know. Did you see it?
Well, you know, I was up at Sundance seeing other films.
That's right. At number 10 is The Theory of Everything. Another Oscar hopeful. Eddie Redmayne is certainly a front runner for Best Actor.
He won the SAG Award, in fact.
That's right. He passed the $80 million mark. Did you look up who won Best Cast?
I thought it was Birdman.
That's right, because it wasn't that the weekend that we had Birdman winning the Producers Guild and the SAG Award. It was sort of a new momentum for that movie.
I believe so, yes.
At number 11 is a movie that'll open up in North America soon, but it opened first overseas. That's SpongeBob SquarePants movie, the second film from the TV series. And $8 million it made in some small markets, so that's a good start. The reviews in Variety and Hollywood Reporter were positive. I'm really looking forward to seeing it because I love the show. Very similarly, opening in the UK is Kingsman, The Secret Service. This is based on a comic book. It's directed by Matthew Vaughn, who did Kick-Ass. And just like that comic book turned into a movie, this one is very adult. It sounds like it's for kids. It's a teenage James Bond type movie, but it takes a dark turn. So don't think this is for the really little kids. You know, this is for adults and for older kids that are savvy enough to handle it. At number 14 is Unbroken, the Angelina Jolie movie, still doing great stuff, $150 million worldwide. And looking down on the list, I think there's not much else new to say.
Yeah, no, other than, you know, you could talk about Annie and how much it's made, only $117 million worldwide.
$85 million for a musical in North America is actually a lot of money, historically speaking. And I believe it only cost $45 million to make. So that movie's going to be in profit.
Okay.
Yeah, the Smiths made a smart movie. They made the movie for the right price.
Unlike, say, Penguins of Madagascar.
Well, that budget was $110 million. What was that budget?
Well, $145 is their average. That's DreamWorks Animation. They actually said last week, in taking yet another write-down and reporting some negative earnings, that they are going to lower the budgets of their films from $140, $145 to $120.
Well, you know, every dollar counts, you know, even if you're talking about, you know, $140 million versus $125 million. It doesn't sound like a lot, but the amount of money you need to gross in order to make that back is, you know, exponentially different, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I believe the budget for that film was $132 million. So you'd want to gross about $390. It's at $330. So it's slowly fading. I'm not sure how many markets it has left. It could get there depending on what markets are still to come, but probably will fall a little short, but it's certainly not a disaster. This is not a movie where you should say, oh my God, it's rocking the foundations of a studio. It costs $130 to make. It grossed $330. It has DVD and video and all that stuff coming where family films tend to do better. So again, even if you lost a little money in the theatrically, this is not a movie that should be an albatross around your neck.
Well, certainly a movie that is not an albatross around Disney India's neck is PK. You might recall this is the highest grossing movie in India of all time. It made $50 million. And guess what? It's actually going to be shown in China. So it's going to be one of the, I guess, 34 films that are allowed to be imported.
They elbowed out Hollywood to get one of the big slots.
Yes.
Right, because only 34 films from overseas get to be shown in China, and most of them end up being Hollywood movies, which frustrates everybody else, of course, and India has managed to snag one. So just getting the release is a big deal for them, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's going to open, I guess, 3,500 screens. It's the highest number of screens for an Indian film.
That's hardly unusual. Surprising, you know, since they haven't opened many Indian films in China, I imagine.
Well, and there's more and more screens to fill. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that's almost a comment not worth making, other than the fact that, you know, Disney India gets to tout it.
In other release date news, J.J. Abrams will not be competing with J.J. Abrams.
Wait, what?
He's a producer on Mission Impossible 5. And he's a director on Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. They were originally both scheduled to come out basically in mid-December, right around the same time. And now, because Mission Impossible 5 is done early and it's ready, Paramount has moved it up to the summertime and to the end of summer into August, where they saw Guardians of the Galaxy reap lots of money with very little competition. They said, hey, let's release it July 31st and make lots of money. So that's what they're doing. They're recognizing that big movies can play anytime around the year, and they avoid making J.J. Abrams unhappy by having two of his movies duke it out in Christmas time.
And they avoid actually getting run over by Star Wars.
Well, that's the other way to put it. Well, yes, Star Wars opened December 18th, and I think Mission Impossible 5 was going to be a big release. No, I don't know. Was that going to be a Christmas Day release?
I believe it was right around, or yeah.
Right, so they would have had 1 week, and it would be week two of Star Wars. Why not give, you know, not exactly great counter programming, so why not give it its own spot when you can?
Yeah, and I think they move, I guess, some kind of like CGI kind of hybrid monster trucks or something like that to December 25th, 2015. And that is Paramount, the studio kind of flip-flopped some of their films and moved some films around. And they kind of, I'd hate to say but monster trucks may have been thrown under the Star Wars bus.
People are going to want to see other movies too.
Yeah.
Is this a family film?
Maybe that's what they're going for. That, like, you know, the five-year-olds don't have any kind of history with Star Wars, so they're not going to want to go, and parents are going to need something to take the kids to on Christmas week, so why not Monster Trucks?
Everybody's
going to
want to see Star Wars.
Yeah, and well, it's...
I think kids were just born. But, yes, you know, there's no reason that other films can't play as well. You know, so it's silly to think, oh, you shouldn't show any movie ever. But I think it's just smarter to take a big, solid franchise like Mission Impossible 5, go to a release date that's empty, like August, and make some money.
Well, do you think everybody's going to want to see Ghostbusters, a remake of Ghostbusters? But here's the catch.
It's not a remake. It's a reboot.
To reboot, all of the cast, instead of having the three or four guys there, will be women.
Well, it makes sense since they started with Melissa McCarthy, who is box office gold right now, hit TV show, hit movies. And she's the person that you would name if you're saying we're going to have women. Who would you want there? Melissa McCarthy would be the first person on just about anyone's list.
And Paul Feig will be directing it. It looks like Kristen Wiig is also in talks, along with Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon, two Saturday Night Live cast members.
I'm just glad it's happening so we don't ever have to hear again about the possibility of Ghostbusters 3.
Yes, thank goodness.
It's been discussed for 30 years. And you know what? This is going to be suck unless they have a good script. I hope they have a good script. I don't even know if they have a script. They're just like, we'll do it with women. Ghosts and women. We're done.
Ghosts, women, get Sigourney Weaver. We're done.
I joked that we didn't care about the SAG Awards. Of course we do. All the awards matter. You know, the Art Directors Guild gave their top awards to Grand Budapest Hotel, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Birdman.
They have kind of strange categories, the Art Directors Guild. And I don't say, maybe I shouldn't say strange, but they have interesting categories. They have kind of a production design awards for kind of like period pieces.
And fantasy sci-fi and, you know, yeah. And contemporary. Very different. People don't think there's production design in a current film. If you make Birdman, you think, you just went to a theater in a Hollywood, you know, on Broadway and shot the movie there. It's like, no. Actually, when you go on the street, they say, well, there's no production design. They decide what cars are there, how much litter is in the ground. Is it wet? Is it rainy? Is it cold? Is it dry? Are there leaves? There's a million choices that they make as far as set design and production design, even in a contemporary film. And so there are lots of choices, even just where to shoot and finding the right different unique locations. You know, it's all challenging and it's all interesting. And people only think it's like when you do a Merchant Ivory film in a grand old estate, beautiful house, beautiful estate. And that wins production design. It tends to be not the best production design, but the most production design, right, which would certainly be what, you know, Grand Budapest Hotel, that has a ton of production design in it. It calls attention to itself in a very delightful way. I actually like the movie a lot, but that is a classic winner of production design because it's so obvious what they're doing and how clever it is. Whereas Birdman, people don't think of the production design involved there, but it's real and it happens.
Well, and I guess there was the upset here is Guardians of the Galaxy winning for fantasy because everybody thought Into the Woods would win.
Why?
Just because it's yeah, I don't know.
Guardians of the Galaxy was a better reviewed, better movie. Why would they think Into the Woods was expected to win? I actually read a fair amount of criticism about the production design of the movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not an upset.
Well, but do you think that How to Train Your Dragon 2, speaking of DreamWorks Animation, it won the Best Animated Feature at the Annie Awards. These are the awards for animated films. It won six awards over the weekend. Box Trolls won 2 and Lego Movie, which apparently everybody in animation hates. It only won one award. Is it just going to sweep the Oscar as well?
Well, there's only one. You can't sweep a single award.
Well, that's why I was halfway through that statement, and I was like, well, you can't really, you know, sweep away the Oscar as well.
It certainly helps, and it makes certain that more people are likely to watch it. You know, you can't, people got to watch the 5 movies, and that's one more product. Yeah, maybe I should watch How to Train Your Dragon 2. So it certainly helps them. It's certainly, I think, the front runner right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's most likely to win. It could be, you know, but that's a category where you're supposed to watch all 5. And it used to be that you had to go in and sit there and watch them and sign off and say, yes, I saw all 5. Now it's the honor system. So in the old days, you'd be more likely to have one of these smaller films that didn't necessarily get a lot of attention win that big award because it's only the people who actually went. And if you see all 5, you might go, wow, that tiny little film by Studio Ghibli is actually delightful, and I'm going to name it. In this case, when you're on your honor system, people are more likely to gravitate towards the big titles that they actually see. And that, I think, favors How to Train Your Dragon 2.
I love the fact that the Annie Award for storyboarding went to How to Train Your Dragon 2. How in the world? Well, I guess animators pick this, so maybe they submit their storyboards. But, you know, it would seem kind of like, how do you see the storyboards?
Well, you don't see the script either, but you see the movie and you know you can anticipate and understand when you're an artist and a craftsperson what they've done to get to that end product. And so you know what the challenges were in storyboarding and how they probably went about doing it and how successful you thought it was in pulling off a unique look.
Well, and you know, we're often criticized for only focusing on stories from the U.S. and North America.
We try desperately not to.
Less and less, because we do try and get a lot of international stories or as many international stories that come our way as possible into the show.
Send us your stories.
dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. But here we have a story from France about the César Awards. And I hate saying this, but everybody compares them to the French equivalent of the Academy Awards.
Now, well, the Academy Awards were first, right?
I suppose, but it, you know, the 40th annual event, so absolutely the César Awards are a little bit younger than the Oscars. But this year, I guess, what, Saint Laurent?
These are the nominations were announced.
Yeah, Saint Laurent led with 10 nominations, including the Best Film and Best Actor for Gaspard Ulliel and Best Director.
Well, there are two films, biopics, about Yves Saint Laurent, and the other one also got a lot of nominations. So, you know, people are going to get sick of Yves Saint Laurent by the time that night is over.
That's true.
But yes, a lot of nominations were out. And again, if you're an actress in France, you must be sick of seeing, Juliette Binoche, Marion Cotillard, Catherine Deneuve. They always get nominated.
And they are, once again.
Yeah, it's got to be very hard to break into the best actress category in France.
But, here's what's interesting. Timbuktu, which is not, I guess it is a French film.
It's a co-production.
It's a co-production, right.
When you colonize Africa, half of Africa, then you end up being involved in their movies as well.
Right. And in this case, Abderrahim Sissako, whose film Timbuktu played in Cannes, it's a wonderful film. It's nominated for Best Foreign Language Feature at the Academy Awards. It's nominated for Best Picture or Best Film and Best Director and Original Screenplay at the Césars.
Of course, it's eligible and it got nominated. Did you see Wild Tales, the Argentinian film that's up for Best Oscar?
Yes, and it was a fun movie.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun. I just saw it this weekend.
It's got probably the best first 10 minutes of a film.
It's more like five or six, but yeah, it's great. It's like a lot of short films. It has a cumulative effect, but there are individual tales, and they don't cross them all together a la our friend at Birdman. But it's, you can enjoy each short. If one of those had been the Oscar short, it would probably be the front runner this year.
I agree.
Now, but I think it's a very good film, and it could win. You know, it's going to be a real contender because it's fun, and all the other dramas in the foreign film category are exhausting, you know? So even if they're good, it's like you've seen four exhausting dramas and then you see this fun black comedy. You're like, thank God.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, I had to reread the headline because Kristen Stewart is up for Best Supporting Actress for her role in Sils Maria. And I think that, you know, I don't know. I just find it
amusing?
Yeah. It's like Kristen Stewart. Wait, she was in a movie? It's like, you know, well, everybody's so down on her, and yet here she is being nominated for a César.
Yeah, she'll have the last laugh. And who knew that Sam Smith, the pop star who's openly gay, and Tom Petty were collaborating on a song?
Well, I don't think they collaborated exactly.
Tell us what happened.
Well, yeah, and so this is part of our music news this week. I guess Sam Smith, he wrote this song, Stay With Me.
Well, a couple people did, not just him, I think.
Yes, and when people first heard it, they went, huh, sounds familiar.
I didn't.
I've heard
did you?
This song
no,
before.
That's not true. There was not a whisper of this song being a ripoff of Don't Back Down. In fact, when they thought they could keep the whole thing quiet, which seems a little silly to me. But no, I don't know. I didn't see a single press story about this song being a ripoff of the other one. In fact, it was a total surprise to me when I found out that they'd reached out to them and all this happened.
Well,
but are you saying you read stuff, or you just made that up as an intro to the story?
No, when the story came out, and this came out over the past week, that basically Tom Petty was added as a songwriter to Stay With Me because his song "Don't Back Down," I won't back down. Okay, is basically the same song melodically.
They just said, look, there's similarities. They contacted them and they said, you're right, there is. We never heard it before, but they're got a similar melodic structure. We absolutely will, you know, give you credit. Everybody's happy. Everybody loves each other. They're air kissing each other. They're all trying their best to make it be very polite and respectful. Nobody's saying, you know, Tom Petty's not saying, you ripped off my song. You know, they're not trying to say that. And the Smith people are like, wow, you know, this happens. And Tom Petty had a very gracious comment. He said, hey, you know, this happens. There's only so many notes and, you know, melodies are out there and things happen. And when it happens, you know, sometimes you write something and you, oh my God, it's like this song. You don't even realize it happens. And then you catch it, or sometimes you don't. And that's what he feels like happened here. And the Sam Smith people are like, oh, we never heard his song before. You know, he's a gay pop singer in the UK. He hasn't heard Tom Petty's song. But they said, as soon as it was brought to their attention, the Petty people contacted them. They sat down, they played the song, and they said, oh my God, it really is similar. let's absolutely give them credit and they'll get royalties and we apologize and then no hurt feelings all around and everybody's lovey-dovey. Everybody's happy. It's a little silly to think they could get away with keeping it secret because they both said, we don't know who leaked the news. Nobody wanted to make it a big deal. Tom Petty said, no lawyers were ever mentioned. That wasn't the, you know, we just reached out respectfully and they responded immediately, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And but now he gets 12.5. Tom Petty gets 12.5% writing credit. And of course, the royalties that go with that.
I mean, you saw the royalties? Because I didn't see that. That wasn't clear to me whether he get back royalties. I believe he gets future royalties based on when they acknowledge it. But I'm not sure.
Oh, I don't
about
know about
that.
I don't know about.
He's also not eligible for the Grammy Award because the song is nominated for Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best Pop Solo Performance. So again, I would say if it was so obvious that he ripped off this song, people, the Grammy people, all the artists would probably go, "Hey, that's a ripoff of that song," and wouldn't have nominated it. I don't know. I played them both back to back. I can see there's a vague similarity, but I don't listen to them and go, that's clearly a ripoff of the other song. Unlike, say, George Harrison with My Sweet Lord and the song that he ripped off. You know, I just don't see the similarity. He's So Fine. That was the Chiffon song that the George Harrison number was so similar to. The second you play those, you go, oh my God, that's literally the same melody. In this case, there's like a vague reference in the chorus. But other than that, I don't associate the two songs at all.
Well, and what we should be doing right now is playing at least clips of both songs back to back to see if, but we don't have clearance to do so.
You don't need clearance to play a clip.
Well, that's true. Maybe we should have done that. Obviously, we didn't prepare well enough. Okay, so that's the Sam Smith song. Now, do you have I Won't Back Down?
Well, give me a second. This world bomb dragging me down, gonna stand my
ground, and I won't back down. So you can actually hear, you can hear it, actually.
All right.
But, yeah, and that's why I think musicians figured it out. But I don't think that the public did, because the Sam Smith song, it's the same chord progressions, the same melody, but much slower.
There you go.
So, but, you know, so you have Sam Smith kind of giving up some royalties, maybe at least future royalties. We're not sure. Now you have Sly Stone, and we haven't heard from Sly Stone in what, like a decade or more? But he is a soul and funk singer and composer. He sued his former manager, Jerry Goldstein, and attorney Glenn Stone, and he won $5 million in back royalties.
It doesn't seem like that much money. I wonder how much money was involved. You know, it seems like 10 or 12 million, I guess, so he got about half of it. But you would think there'd be a lot more money at stake with Sly and the Family Stone, because that's a very valuable property. You know, he's a great artist. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He has a couple albums that are hugely influential on Prince and a million other artists. Probably wasn't selling tens of millions of copies back in the day. This is the early 70s before we had the mega album success story. You know, he was big in the late 60s and early 70s. But, you know, those songs are perennials. And so I imagine his publishing and all that, they're worth a lot. I'm not sure what the manager did, but clearly the jury agreed that he ripped off Stone.
Well, what the complaint, the original complaint, which was filed in 2010 in a Los Angeles court, he sings Everyday People and Family Affair. So,
right.
You know,
among millions of others.
Yeah. And the complaint basically says, look, you know, in all of the royalties that were going from Sony, I guess it was Columbia Records at the time, all the publishing royalties going to Jerry Goldstein's company never made their way to Sly Stone. And that,
it's not like he took his cut. He took it all.
Yeah. It's like, well, let's see, 5% for me and 95% for me. So this guy Goldstein even went and borrowed against Sly Stone's future earnings. So
you wouldn't think that'd be legal.
Yeah, you wouldn't. But so, of course, Goldstein and his attorney, they said, we're going to appeal this. So who knows? It's probably going to take forever for Sly Stone to make that money or get that hold of that money.
One who knows what money they have left.
Well, that's true.
But it's you know, justice in the court system. At least he won at court.
Yeah, on the court.
But for him, it's a big deal.
Well, I'm sure it would be if he got $5 million. But for us, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? The Super Bowl is always a massive ratings draw, but it helps when the football game being played is, you know, actually a good one and not a blowout. The planets aligned for last night's game. There was controversy about deflated footballs, the two teams were actually the two best teams from each conference, and the game itself went down to the final minutes. The result? It looks like this Super Bowl, the one played yesterday, will be the seventh in the last, I guess, 8 years to set records in viewership. It looks as if more than 110 million people tuned in. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It happens every year, right?
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
It's the Super Bowl. It draws a big audience. There are commercials and there are movie trailers and we watch. And it was a good game and then it's over. But I'll tell you what I'll remember is that halftime show by Missy Elliott. She really kicked ass.
Katy Perry was the halftime show.
That's right. But all anybody seems to talk about is Missy Elliott because she stole the show from her.
Really? You think so?
Every review I read said that.
Yeah, Katy Perry flying around the arena with fireworks and everything. How could that be stolen? She came out on a big giant tiger or lion or whatever it was.
Of course. So you liked it.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, this is the first time my daughters watched the Super Bowl.
Of course.
They now know what an incomplete pass is. And I told them that's the only pass they should ever know about. Okay. Finally, somebody laughs at that joke. I said it last night. Nobody laughs. I'm like, get it? They're girls. Incomplete pass. They shouldn't.
Keep going.
Okay. I guess when you have to explain your jokes during the Super Bowl. Probably a bad idea. So they could not wait for Katy Perry. Once they found out Katy Perry was the halftime show, which I made the mistake of telling them in the first quarter, that's all they wanted to see.
Of course.
And so I was delayed by about an hour. They did not want me to skip the commercials. They liked the commercials more than the game.
Well, duh.
And they were just, as the halftime show kind of came up, they were so frustrated that they kept stopping the clock. Because they thought as soon as it hit zero, boom, there you're going to get Katy Perry. But no, there's a whole bunch of talking heads for 20 minutes before you get Katy Perry.
And their review?
They thought it was great.
Oh, cool.
And I kept saying, oh, look, she's lip syncing. Because, of course, you always lip sync at an event like that because you can't afford to have a huge mistake where the mic cuts out or something happens. And she did a good job.
Cool.
But my youngest daughter, she's not lip syncing. She's really singing. I was like, okay. She just kept saying that. But you didn't see it at all, huh?
Nope, not yet.
But you can go online and see it.
I will.
If this winter feels cold to you, you're probably living in the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah, okay. Now, well, imagine how it feels to fans of George R.R. Martin. Those eagerly awaiting the next installment in the Songs of Ice and Fire series have to content themselves with a new season on HBO and screenings on IMAX. They haven't had a book since 2011, and now Martin's publisher has confirmed it won't be coming out in 2015. When will it be done? It'll be done when it's done. As fellow author Neil Gaiman blogged to impatient fans, George Martin is not your bitch. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, he'll finish when he finishes. Leave him alone. However, we forgot to mention in the box office about IMAX screenings of the Game of Thrones. They showed the final two episodes of last season remastered for IMAX, not shot in IMAX, obviously, but they did what they could to gussy them up for the big screen. And then they showed a trailer for the new season. They played it on 200 screens around the country and it grossed $1.5 million, a very respectable $7,000 per screen average. You know
good.
What that means? They're going to keep doing it.
They will be doing this again and again until it fails a couple times.
Like The Walking Dead. And you know what the movie theaters really want, of course, is to be able to show the season premiere like a week before it airs on TV. That's what they want.
That would be nice
for people who have to pay. But yeah, it'd be great. They can have original content that people could see the season premiere or the season finale before anybody else. That's what would really bring them into the IMAX theaters.
Well, speaking of changing viewing habits, details are sparse, but Nickelodeon is going over the top. Yes, the cable channel will be offering a standalone service available online soon, following in the wake of HBO and countless others who think unbundling themselves might just be more profitable after all. Pricing, what it will include, and when it will be available will all come out soon, will be published soon. The Nick Jr. app has been a top seller since it launched last year, so the network is confident family-friendly fare has an audience that will pay for Nickelodeon anywhere. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, everyone is going to have their over-the-top cable channel made available any way you want, right? Everybody's saying all the big conglomerates have realized there's money to be made and they're going to do it. But I still think, like you, once you've got 8 or 10 channels, suddenly it's costing you about $80, $90 a month.
Yeah, because it's $9.99 for this one and $9.99
for that
one.
HBO, Netflix, yeah. Nickelodeon. You know, suddenly you're going to think, oh, gee, golly, maybe that bundling wasn't so bad after all.
Yeah, I agree. According to a survey paid for by a security technology firm called, how do you pronounce this? Irdito?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Some 70% of Russians watch pirated movies and TV shows, and 16% watch such illegal content regularly. The number one reason? Legal services are too expensive. So not the legal services of a lawyer, but the legal streaming services are too expensive. That's followed quickly by not wanting to wait for the local release date for shows like Game of Thrones, which we just talked about, and the show simply not being available at all in their market. This rate of piracy is much higher than in the US, UK, Australia, Singapore, and India, other countries where this company has paid for similar surveys. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it reinforces what we believe, which is that people around the world are so aware of shows now that they don't want to wait. They don't care about what your rights and your rules and your licensing and all that stuff. They just know Game of Thrones opened in the US and I'm in Australia and I want to see it. You know, they're Walking Dead. Doesn't matter what the show is. If it's big, they want to see it. They don't want to wait. Downton Abbey, old people, if old people were online doing piracy, they would be downloading Downton Abbey, for God's sake. It opens up in the UK and takes like a couple months before it comes to the US. It would drive them nuts. Luckily, they can't figure out their internet ISP.
Why are you so down on old people?
I'm not down on them at all. I'm just saying they tend to be less tech savvy, and therefore they're less likely to pirate. And that's the only reason why you're not seeing shows like Downton Abbey on the list as well. But I mean, Russia's really clamped down on a lot of stuff. I mean, Russia's in the news for this piracy. And in fact, one Russian director is encouraging people to do a little piracy. And that is the director of Leviathan. His name is Andrei Zvigintsev.
Andrei Zvigintsev.
Thank you very much. Terrific director. I've loved his earlier movies like The Return and Elena. His new movie, Leviathan, is up for Best Foreign Film at the Oscars. And unfortunately, when it was shown in Russian theaters, they muffled out or bleeped out or cut out all the cursing. They said, no cursing in movies anymore. And he's like, that's ridiculous. You can't make an adult film sometimes without cursing. It's embarrassing. So he says, go see the movie and then go home and download it illegally and watch the stuff so you can get a sense of what the dialogue was supposed to be like. So he's literally asking people to go download a movie illegally.
And it's a good movie. Elena is a great movie, and Leviathan is a great movie. I wouldn't be shocked if it wins best foreign language film.
Well, it's a good mix of movies. We'll have to see what wins. But Leviathan, Wild Tales, Ida, there's a lot of good movies competing in the foreign language category.
You know, there are hits, and then there are phenomenons. American Idol, for instance, was a phenomenon for Fox when it debuted many years ago as a summer series that grew and grew thanks to water cooler chatter. Well, the music drama Empire isn't a smash on that level, but after a very strong debut, Empire grew in the ratings its second week when most shows begin to fall. In fact, most shows drop by, what, like 30%? And if you can drop less than
only,
30%.
Yeah, if you drop only 30% and then you stabilize, you're doing well.
Yeah. Instead, in its third week, Empire grew again in the ratings, and it's more Dallas than Def Jam. Empire is proving catnip for audiences looking for a fresh nighttime soap, and Fox couldn't be happier. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's not a game changer for Fox yet. It's not a hit on that level, but growing 3 weeks in a row is huge. That just does not happen much on television anymore. So this looks like a real big long-term hit for the network, and God knows they needed one.
Netflix formally announced they plan to take on another $1 billion in debt.
Just like us.
I was going to say, hey, you know what? Throw some our way. They're doing this to finance content acquisitions and creation. And this was one of the talks of Sundance about how much money Netflix and similar services are spending to get their content. Because without the content, they have no company. Basically, Netflix said interest rates were so low that long-term debt was the best way to make funds available for shows like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. Not to mention paying for reruns of shows created by others. All told, they'll be airing 320 hours of original programming, which is more than triple the hours they aired in 2014. Standard & Poor's downgraded their credit rating on the news. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. What about you?
I think it could be a big deal, especially if they cannot grow as quickly as they hope. Certainly in the U.S., they've kind of plateaued a bit. They're growing overseas. They hope to be in 170-some-odd countries by the end of this year or 2016. They have to grow for this to make any sense.
Do any of the studios take on long-term debt in order to finance their movies?
Not long-term debt. They very often take on short-term debt. So they'll take bridge financing so that they can, you know, actually complete the film. And then, you know, it gets paid off over time. But usually not.
All right.
They'll do it for operations. You know, it's more of a broad strategy than specific to content.
Well, I guess there isn't much other than content that Netflix has, right?
That's, well, you know, operations. I mean, all of right. the streaming costs and things such as that. But, you know, certainly at Sundance, the comments were, you know, oh, Netflix and Amazon. And I'm hearing it even upon returning home, the talk of, well, Netflix has some movies, but nothing I really want to watch, mostly television.
Right.
Whereas Amazon has more movies and none of them have anything current.
Well, that's, of course not.
And I don't necessarily buy that because Amazon Prime, at least, has lots of Paramount movies and Disney movies that are current.
By current, you mean out in theaters within the last year?
Yeah, year or two, yes.
Well, speaking of Sundance, that's what our highlight in Inside Baseball, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Hello, and welcome to Good Idea, Bad Idea, the game show where we look at movie deals and tell you whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. Our first contestant is Sperling Reich. You're a co-host of Showbiz Sandbox. Isn't that right, Sperling?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Oh, very good. And you live in?
Los Angeles, California.
And you're just down the road from?
Everybody in Hollywood.
That's true. That's an amazing story. Anyway, moving on. So we're looking at the movies that were sold at Sundance, and we're going to decide whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. Are you ready, Sperling?
A good idea that they appeared at Sundance or a good idea that they were sold at Sundance?
Yeah, you're one step ahead of me, Sperling. A good idea whether the price paid for the movie was a good idea. Are you ready?
I am ready, yes.
First up is The Bronze. I don't know what the movie is, but I know it was bought for $3 million. Sperling, was that a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, you know, I always go with it could be a good idea, but it always depends.
That's not how the game is played, Sperling.
Well, it depends who picked it up. In this case, Relativity Media picked up The Bronze. So this is an iffy move. I would say it's a bad idea. The film got middling to negative reviews. I've seen the film. It's hilarious. It's crass. It's vulgar. Can it make $3 million? Well, given that you probably have to put another $3 million to $4 million into marketing and prints and advertising, can it make $6 million? Only one film from last year's Sundance Film Festival made over $1 million, and that's Whiplash. I don't know. This is a tough call. I'd have to say bad idea.
Ooh, only one film made more than $1 million at the box office?
I think so. I could be wrong about that, but it does seem like only Whiplash made,
any money?
Yeah, correct.
Whiplash, of course, has grossed more than $8 million at the North American box office and is nominated for?
Best Picture. That's why right. So many people are showing up at Sundance. You got Precious making money and being nominated for Best Picture, also a Sundance film. So
one potential film that could be nominated for Best Picture in 2016 is Brooklyn, based on the best-selling novel by Colm Tóibín. I love the book. Sperling, Brooklyn was purchased for $9 million. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
Now, I'm going to play studio executive here. And what I mean by that is the studio executive who does not go see the film, but hears from all of their acquisitions executives whether the film was any good and how much they should pay for it. $9 million, you say? I didn't see it. People loved this movie. This got rave reviews, especially for women. And so I would say, good idea. If you put another $9 million into prints and advertising, you could actually make some money. Who actually picked this up? Is it not
Fox Searchlight?
Fox Searchlight, yes. Especially if Fox Searchlight. They actually get behind the movies they acquire. Kind of like Sony Picture Classics, they get behind the movies they acquire.
Who doesn't get behind the movies
they
acquire?
Oh, you'd be shocked. You know, some of these acquisitions, they'll kind of peter out. Like, they'll be picked up for $1.5 million, and then they'll kind of open, they'll make, you know, $400,000 or $500,000, and nobody actually pushes the movie. Well, in this case, Brooklyn, it's going to be pushed.
And they may have a potential Oscar winner. Sperling, this is a game show, so let's try that again. Brooklyn, $9 million. Good idea or bad idea?
Good idea.
Thank you. Diary of a Teenage Girl. $2 million was the purchase price. Who bought it, and was it a good idea or a bad idea?
Good idea. It was purchased by Sony Picture Classics, who always makes award pushes for their films and their acquisitions. They are great with this type of movie.
But it's more of a young film. Normally, Sony is known for art house and foreign film. And is this more of a younger movie than they typically do?
Yeah, maybe, but not really. No, this is a kind of a 20s and up. So this is a film that will appeal to a lot of women. It's a good movie, and I was surprised it didn't win more at this year's festival. I guess it won something, right? I mean,
I don't know.
I think it won screenwriting or editing. I can't remember, but I should have probably looked that up beforehand. it was one of my top films at this year's festival, and so it's a good idea.
Moving on, Dope, one of the big successes of Sundance. It was purchased for a huge $7 million. It's the second biggest amount that we're talking about here. Good idea or bad idea?
Well, okay, this was purchased by a company called Open Road. Open Road is a relatively new distributor that was put together by AMC, Regal, and I think just AMC and Regal, to go out and find art films to kind of fill in the gaps for, those are movie theater chains. They need not just big tentpole movies, but something to fill the in-between times. $7 million for a film that was really a lot of fun and one of the better films I saw up there at Sundance this year. I would say you're going to have to put another $7 million into it. It's a good idea, but boy, Open Road is going to have to step up their game to support this film.
So you're,
and I think they can do it. I think they can do it. Tom Ortenberg is no dummy who runs Open Road. I think that it's a good idea.
You've just done something that I hate when journalists do. They say, the head of that company is no dummy. You're not about to tell me the head of another company that is a dummy, are you?
No, I'm not going to tell you who is a dummy, but I'm not going to, I would just, if you don't have anything nice to say, why bother saying it at all?
Me and the Earl and the Dying Girl, the biggest success story of the festival. Early word was that it was bought for $12 million. More like $6 million, but this was the big hit. It won the Audience Award. It won the Grand Jury Award, just like Whiplash did last year. This is the film of the festival. They got it for $6 million. Was it a steal? And was it a good idea or a bad idea?
It was a good idea, especially since Fox Searchlight picked it up. And again, this is the company that really knows how to release these types of movies, Garden State and movies like that. Definitely a good idea to go to that company. $6 million. Put another $15 million into it. You can probably do quite well with this. Here's the caveat. Okay, last week I told you how I got shut out of this screening. Was too back from the press and industry screening. I tried to see this movie countless times after that. Normally, when a film does like Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, kind of sells out their press and industry screening or shuts out so many people, they will rerun the film. They did it with The Witch. However, because Fox Searchlight picked it up, I'm speculating here, but I think Fox Searchlight said, we have all the buzz we want from the press out of this. Do not run it again.
Fair enough.
And so a lot of the journalists and a lot of the industry was really ticked off that basically all the important journalists got to see it, but not most of the journalists who spend their time.
Not the bread and butter journalists.
Exactly.
And so you think they've created a little ill will?
I think so, because not only did we try to do it through the PNI, the official press and industry screenings, but we also tried to do wait lists. There was nobody getting in on the wait list. We also tried to go through the press office to get tickets. Nobody, all the screenings were sold out. And of course, on the final day, when most, if not everybody, has left after the awards ceremony, they ran it twice. But who's there? Nobody's there anymore. So
it's bad for Sundance if journalists come and they can't come away having seen the big film.
I completely
agree. It's going to happen sometimes, but if you literally go out of your way to make that happen, then that could be trouble.
Right, and I think in this case, I don't want to say they went out of their way to make it happen, but I would hope that the festival could have said, look, Fox Searchlight, listen, you got to show this again. You had 200 people, 200 members of the press and industry, at least, waiting to get into this screening. You got to show it again. They decided not to.
And that's really sort of silly, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the overnight, $4 million.
But what I would like to say with this is this film that was sold for, what, you say $6, $7 million, and why I say you could put another 15 into it and still be fine, is being compared to The Fault in Our Stars, but better. Now, The Fault in Our Stars made $100 million.
Well, it wasn't a well-reviewed movie, but that doesn't mean it's going to make that money. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's based on a phenomenal novel that, you know, was a huge, huge property.
And everybody across the board, even the people who were detractors of Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, were saying, yeah, it's a good movie. So they said, I didn't like it, but it's a good movie. Everybody across the board, speaking to dozens of people, loved this movie when they saw it. So,
all right.
Good idea.
The Overnight, $4 million. Good idea or bad idea?
Whoa, my goodness. I would say, now this is a new company that picked this up. It's called The Orchard. It could be you're going to have to put another $3 to $4 million.
So they wanted to make their name.
Yeah.
And they wanted to show we're here to play. We're here with money. And so they pay perhaps a premium for a movie to make a statement about, hey, we're a new kid on the block. We've got a checkbook. We're ready to play. And so that's sort of maybe why this happened for this price.
Yes, I think so. It's got Jason Schwartzman in it. A couple of other big name. I don't know. Bad idea.
But if it's a long-term investment in the company and saying, hey, we've got to get out there and let people know we're here, perhaps that's where it's a good idea for the company to say, hey, we are a player. We can do it. We can write checks. You know, does it buy them goodwill and let people know, hey, we want to take them seriously?
For right now, yes. But if they don't handle the film well, then no. Then it's like, okay, so you're known for overpaying for something that you then don't support or release properly.
How often do people turn down a higher offer?
Actually, it does happen. It depends on the film, the producers, the investors, and whether they are and what they really their goal for the film is. They'll turn down a higher offer to go with a distributor that's really going to be better for the film.
I don't hear about that happening very much.
Well, they don't exactly advertise the fact that they've done
it. Well, no, they'd love to. They say, look, we went with a lower price because we believe in them. That's a big thing to tout. We could have gotten more money. If they don't make the noise about that, they're stupid.
I think John, remember the film Don John? Why am I forgetting his name?
What, Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Thank you. He made this film. He
don't directed, you ever forget the name of Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I know, you love him. he made this film, and I guess he had higher offers, all cash, but he decided to go with lower money with a bigger P&A guarantee.
Uh-huh. Well, bigger P&A guarantee. That's part of the whole cost, though.
Right. But the money was guaranteed up front, meaning we're only going to give you $4 million in cash, but we're going to spend $25 million pushing this film out there and getting all the print and advertising and the marketing behind it. Guaranteed. Well, all of a sudden, a filmmaker says, that's great. I could get $7 million in my pocket today or film $4 million with a $25 million guaranteed spend. I'll do the latter.
Well, and it grossed $30 million worldwide. So whether they made money on that or not, I'm not sure. But it was a, you know, they certainly got box office traction for a small film. Finally,
yes.
Cop Car. We don't know how much it was sold for, about $1 million, 1.5, something like that.
I know a lot of people, after its big screening, a lot of people kind of dropped out of the bidding because it had gone too high. This is a film produced by Kevin Bacon, starring Kevin Bacon, or co-starring Kevin Bacon, because the real stars of the film are two 10-year-old boys who find an abandoned cop car, a sheriff's cruiser, and they steal it. The only problem is, well, I'm not going to even tell you what the problem is. Let's just say Kevin Bacon, who is the sheriff, he wants his car back very badly. And it's just it's a lot of fun. It's a very tight movie. It's very well told. This is a good idea. They're going to release it in 25 markets. And this is Focus World. This is the kind of VOD arm of Focus Features. They're going to release it in 25 markets and in the UK simultaneously on VOD and theatrically. It's probably a good idea.
All right. Thank you for playing Good Deal, Bad Deal as a
what
party prize.
What about IFC Films, The D Train?
Oh, did I skip that over? The D Train, $3 million.
Bad
good idea or bad?
Bad
why?
Idea.
Why?
Just because it stars Jack Black does not mean that it's going to make $3 million, i.e. Bernie, you know, which Richard Linklater directed.
What a terrific film that was.
Yeah, and it's a decent film, The D Train, but not great. And it needed to be great because it's kind of a downer of a movie. And it's $3 million. You have to put another $3 million into it theatrically. I don't.
Why do you always say it's double whatever they paid for it is what they have to do in order to
you have to market the
release
film.
Release it. Yeah, I know. But you always, if it's $2 million, you say, well, another $2 million, $3 million, ah, another $3 million, $4 million, well, another $4 million. It seems suspicious that it's always the doubling of whatever.
I'm just kind of doing that for argument's sake.
Okay.
And I would say, I don't know if you can make $6 million with this unless you handle it in a in a major way, and IFC Films purchased it. I don't see that happening.
Jack Black has never starred in a film that grossed less than $2 million. Bernie grossed $9 million in North America.
Okay, so maybe I'm wrong.
Margot at the Wedding, I wouldn't say he was a star in that, right?
Right.
That's less than $2 million. You have to go back to Jesus the Son, which is a Billy Crudup film. He had a small role in that. I don't think that counts. Cradle Will Rock, that's also $2.8 million. But basically, you know, his movies, 8, 10, 12, 30, 40, 50, 60 million, you know, he has, you know, The Big Year only grossed $7 million. Burning grossed $9 million. Gulliver's Travels, $42 million. Year One, $43 million. And then the big movies, Kung Fu Panda, Tropic Thunder, Be Kind, Rewind even made $11 million. So, you know, I don't know what the budget was or what they paid, but, you know, he does not. If Jack Black's in a movie, stars in it, you're probably going to make $3 million.
Yeah, and I might be wrong about Cop Car. It might not be 25 markets. That was 10,000 Saints, which sold. There's no price tag on that. But Screen Media Films picked up 10,000 Saints, starring Ethan Hawke and Asa Butterfield and Halle Steinfeld. It's kind of a coming-of-age film. They're going to release it in 25 theatrical markets and day-and-date VOD. But
so is that the story for Cop Car as well?
I don't know whether it's the story. I think I may have missed.
Oh, okay.
So Cop Car is definitely a simultaneous release.
Oh, it is?
Yes. I just don't know whether it's in those 25 markets again.
Oh, but it is definitely a day-and-date release.
Yes.
Which is very common for art houses, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean,
you see that
a lot now. IFC movies are available even before they come out theatrically. They're available on video on demand and things like that.
Yes, and I talked to a number of exhibitors thinking that I knew the answer to the question I was asking, which is, what do you think of VOD? You probably hate it, just like the big guys, the big theater chains do. They said, you know what? It's not great, but you know what? It's not bad for us. You know why? The big chains don't play the film. And because of that, everybody knows that whatever film is being released simultaneously isn't going to be at the Regal, isn't going to be at the AMC, isn't going to be at the Odeon. So you know what? They look at us first. And it's those films have done quite well for the art houses.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for Big Deal, Big Whoop. That wraps it up for Inside Baseball, doesn't it?
Yeah. Although, you know, one thing we should point out as we exit here is that you're hearing a lot of big numbers and a lot of sales and a lot of acquisitions. Over the past couple of years, probably 2-3 years ago, you didn't hear as much. And that's because DVDs had gone away. There was no guarantee that, well, if the film kind of barely earned its money back or maybe didn't earn its money back in the theater.
You didn't have that safety net of DVD sales and rentals.
That's right. You didn't have that. Well, all of a sudden, here comes VOD, here comes Netflix, here comes Amazon. There's some of this kind of over-the-top VOD money. Well, you know what? I think that you're going to see this pendulum swing from paying barely anything to nothing to paying way too much. And I think if we're not there now, we will be next year, where people are kind of just scrambling and paying too much for films that they think they can earn money back due to VOD. And it's just going to eventually swing back the other way.
Well, that's the way it always works, doesn't it?
Yes. But the good news for our listeners is they'll get to see many of these movies.
And the better news is that some people died.
What?
So we have some
Wait a
obituaries.
Second. How is that better news?
Well, they love obituaries. The charming section where we talk about the people who died.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess this week we're going to be talking about Colleen McCullough, who died at the age of 77. She now, Michael, you know a lot more about her than I do, so I'm not going to...
Well, she's the author of The Thornbirds, right, which was published in 1977, sold 30 million copies, became a massive miniseries, one of the biggest hits of all time. She never did anything else remotely comparable to it. She had other books. They were bestsellers. She was, you know, successful throughout her career, but this was it, baby. This was the book. It was the one. And she was basically like heading to London to be a nurse when the book sold. I mean, she was not a working writer at all. She worked at Yale, but she was not a professor. But she saw Eric Segal have this ridiculous success with Love Story, and she thought, well, why not? I can do that. And by God, she was right. And she got about as good reviews as he did. But she sold The Thornbirds, sold a ton of copies. It's the Gone with the Wind for Australia. Some people consider it like that. It's just a sweeping epic tale. And, you know, she saw the miniseries, and it couldn't have been bigger. It was one of the biggest hits literally ever. I think it was the second highest rated miniseries of all time, right behind Roots. And in 2000, this Colleen McCullough was a very salty Aussie. And when she was asked what she thought of it, she's told People magazine, I hated it. It was instant vomit.
So what did you really think?
Yeah, exactly. So, but she died at 77, but great career, salty old broad who had fun with her success, so more power to her. The same could be said for Rod McEwen.
Now, he is a poet and lyricist, and I guess you say he's one of the coolest of the cool.
No, I said once he was considered the coolest of the cool. No. This is a guy who never had critical acclaim, though he would say otherwise. He had dozens of books of poetry that he sold, and they sold millions of copies. Books of poetry that sold millions of copies, that just doesn't happen. Like a big bestseller in poetry would be like 5,000 copies, 10,000 copies. And he was selling millions. He was everywhere. Frank Sinatra, who's one of the great judges of songs in music history, devoted an entire album to the music of Rod McEwen. He's the only artist that Sinatra ever did that for.
What's the name of the album?
Like Rod McEwen, whatever, you know, a man in his music, not a man in his music, but a man, blah, blah, blah. It's not very good. Don't go listen to it.
Okay.
It's terrible. But McEwen wrote thousands of songs. He adopted songs by Jacques Brel and championed him, among others. Seasons in the Sun, that horrible 70s hit, that was a Jacques Brel song that he translated into English. But at one point, Rod McEwen had spoken word albums. He had music albums. He had concerts at Carnegie Hall. He was best-selling books. He was writing film music and classical music. He got Pulitzer Prize nominations, Academy Award nominations. He won a Grammy Award. He had a TV special. He was just it. He was everywhere in the mid-60s and late 60s. He was known for phrases. It's like, it doesn't matter who you love or how you love, but that you love.
Ooh.
And also, listen to the warm. And so everybody had a copy of his albums. Everybody had a copy of his books. He was everywhere. Critics hated him. And he's like, I don't care. Just like Colin McCullough, he enjoyed his success right up to the end. And I think someday someone's going to make a very fun biopic about him, as long as they're not making fun of him. It would be very easy to make fun of his spoken word albums and stuff, but he was sincere, he had fun, and I think it could be a really, really cool project to bring back Rod McEwen and the stuff that he did, because he was a real pop culture phenomenon.
You heard it here first. Michael Giltz is working on a biopic of the recently...
Listen to the warm.
Yes, exactly. Okay, well, you know, that kind of wraps up this week's show. And if you have any comments or thoughts or maybe a plot line for Michael's new biopic of Rod McEwen, you can send them to us. Dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free, or wherever you find a place to listen to podcasts. We're usually there. So please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in any one of those aggregators. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, those ways to email us or to call us, also ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. You can also like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, if you didn't know where you could find any of this information, showbizsandbox.com, our website, is the place. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael, you always have a website that's new and revolving every week. What is it this week?
RodMcEwenLives.com.
RodMcEwenLives.com. Okay, it's not a .org.
No.
Okay, well, you know, if you have trouble finding the writing of Michael Giltz on RodMcEwenLives.com, why not head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of his work and writing about the entertainment industry, or MichaelGiltz.com, or you can even try out BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.